Welcome to week one, part two, Origins. I am Brandon Appelhans, and we are going to be stepping through the theological basis of creation. In this week, we're going to be talking about what got made, how it got made, why it got made, and then in the next section, we're going to talk about how it broke, what that actually means, and how that impacts us. Now, we talk about creation. We have to start by talking about what God did in the beginning, right? We have to start at the very beginning. There's no other place to start. So, for this, we're going to talk about how these human beings got made and what that means. Which means starting in Genesis 1. In Genesis 1, 26 through 28, God has already made the world. He's already made the animals, he's made the skies, he's made the birds, he's made the plants. And then in the middle of this, he says, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Now we see in the beginning that God seems to care a lot for these human beings. It's not just that he says, "Okay, I've made a bunch of stuff. Now I'm going to make a man and a woman. I'm going to put them in the garden, and I'm going to put them in a place to enjoy everything that I've made." Instead, he says, "Let us make man and woman in our likeness, in our image." And these are really big, loaded terms in Hebrew. This does not mean something small. This means something really big. Before we get too far into this, I want to tell you a little bit about me. The reason being, I love this stuff. I went to seminary to train to be a pastor, and then I ended up starting a mental health nonprofit. And so the idea of working through the theology of how people are made and why they're made and how this piece works together, this means everything to me. I spent a decade doing this work, and I'm starting to do it again. So, that is to say, we're going to get pretty nerdy about this stuff. And I think that's exactly the way it should be, because I want you to have a full theological basis for understanding how it works. That said, let's jump back in. So when God says, so God created mankind in his own image, in the image of God he created them, male and female he created them, there are a few things that we need to point out. The first thing that we need to point out is that in this passage, God doesn't create man in his image, and then woman kind of like comes out and does stuff. It's man and woman in his own image. That means that the man and the woman are both created fully in the image of God. So when we talk about things like what it means to be fully alive, if I use mankind or something like that, you can just generalize it. These are human conditions. This is a human way of being made. Now, we used this slide last week because we were talking about a shadow and how we couldn't understand what the person would look like just from their shadow. And in some ways, that's what image and likeness are like. They're kind of like a shadow. The reason being that image and likeness are these big loaded terms in Hebrew because God is creating for himself something that is like himself on earth. He's not creating himself. He's not saying, "This is God. And now it's on earth." He alone is God, right? But what he is doing is he's creating an image, a likeness of himself, and placing it in the world. He's almost creating like his own shadow. It's something that resembles him, that is like him in some ways, that's there in the world, that's tangible, that people can see, touch, because it's themselves. Now, the word for image that he's using here, God making our image and our likeness, this is a really, really powerful, powerful word. It's the word tselem. And it means illusion or resemblance, which is why we're using that shadow. This is something that resembles himself. And it's used throughout the entire Old Testament. Just like in Genesis 9:6, where it says, "Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind." Right? This is the image, this is his representation, so we need to take it really seriously. Or when he goes on and says, "When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own representation, someone that was like him, in his own image, and he named him Seth." And then further, in Numbers 33, it says, "Drive out the inhabitants of the land before you destroy all their before you. Drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. Destroy all their carved images and their cast idols, and demolish their high places." In Numbers 33:52. Now, where is this image and likeness in Numbers 33? Well, it's also the word used for an idol, which is where some of the power of this word comes from in Hebrew. Now, idols were something used throughout the entire Near East, right? We have a god. We need to make a representation of that god. Okay, we make this thing. This is our golden calf. This is our image. This is our Asherah. This is our image that represents God. That idol is the thing that helps us get in touch with that god, that helps us worship that god, that is in some ways a gateway to that god. Because we don't see that god tangibly face to face, but we see this piece, this image, this thing. So, in the ancient Near East, idols are considered one of the most valuable things that you can have, right? This is your connection to your god. So, if God says, "We're made in his image and likeness," this isn't just a statement of, "They're made like me." It's a statement about value. This is something incredibly highly valued. A person in the ancient Near East would value nothing higher than their idol, because this was their connection to their god. If their connection went away, their crops would go away, their family would go away. They would stop being able to bear children, or their land, or their cattle would start having problems. Like, their connection to God meant everything, because God provided everything. So your idol meant more to you than anything. So in that, when God says, "They are made my image and likeness," this is not some small thing. It's, these are literally the thing that I'm making to represent myself, to be like me in the world, to take care of it. To be not little gods like, "This is actually me," but to be the representations of God. These are the human beings are the same as the images of Baal, or the images of, you know, the Asherah poles and things like that. These are the connections to who God is. As an aside, this is why when we read the commandments, it says, "Do not make an image or idol of God, because you are it." Right? And your value and your worth as a human being is based on that. It's based on you are actually the representation of who God is. And because of that, there is nothing more valuable in the universe apart from God himself than you. And to God, you might be the most important thing in the world, because he made you, he cares about you, and you are the thing that he's chosen. You're like his kids. This is the thing that I made that means everything to me. So for God to say we're making human beings in our image and likeness, this is a very, very, very deep, very, very profound statement. Now, he goes on from that to talk about likeness. Likeness is a different word. You can see the transliteration there. It's dimut. And it's used throughout the Old Testament. But it means to be like. It's from the root dema. And we see this in Ezekiel 1:5. Also out of the midst, therefore, came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Next it says, then King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tilgath-Pileser, king of Assyria. Yeah. Then King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tilgath-Pileser, king of Assyria. He gave an altar in Damascus and sent to Uriah the priest a sketch of the altar, which detailed the plans for its construction. Right, do we see this likeness? These are the plans. This is the likeness. And behold, in Daniel 10:16, and behold, one like the similitude of the sons of men touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spake, and said unto him that stood before me, O my Lord, by the vision my sorrows are turned upon me, and I have retained no strength. The one like the similitude, right? There's this. This is just like it. This is almost like an image, like a projection on a TV screen. This is something just like what I saw. Now, it's important to ask who is included in this image and likeness. And the reason that's so important is because the idea that we are made in the image of God, that we are in the Latin imago Dei, right? Image of God. It's been dissected for centuries. And people have made all sorts of different arguments about it. Is it because we have the ability to reason? Is it because we have the ability to make moral reasoning arguments? Is it because we have the ability to care? Is it because we have the ability and authority to do things? What is it that makes you an image of God? And I want to say that there is a really easy test for this, which is, those might all be true, but I want to give you the Karen test. And this is not related to anything about, the name Karen in society today. This is related to my great aunt Karen. And this is not actually a picture of my great aunt Karen, but someone who looks a lot like my great aunt Karen. We didn't have really great photos of her. And the reason it has to pass the Karen test is because Karen had Down syndrome. And then she lived to be in her late 60s and developed severe Alzheimer's. So she could only remember about 30 seconds at a time, and she had the reasoning capacity of probably a 6-year-old, maybe less. Her whole life consisted of having her Diet Coke, which she treasured. And then caring for the people around her. When you were in a room with Karen, it was a really different experience, because when she first met you, she'd go, "Who are you?" And then you would tell her, and then she would give you a hug. And then she would sit down with her Coca-Cola, and she would hold it in both hands. And about 20 seconds later, she'd look over and say, "Who are you?" And then she'd run over and give you a hug. And then she'd hold her Coca-Cola in both hands. And then she might get distracted by something. A few minutes later, she'd look over and go, "Who are you?" Run over and give you a hug. And then hold her Coca-Cola in both hands. The reason that's important is because the Imago Dei is not just limited to the Einsteins of this world that have incredible capacity for intellectual reasoning. It's also people like Karen. So if our definitions don't match the reality of people existing in the image of God, we don't need to say, "Oh, those people aren't image bearers." We need to adjust our definitions. In this case, we need to say that maybe it's not just how well you can reason, but maybe it's also the innate value and worth that you have as a human being. That image and likeness maybe are about the value of your own soul and about the value of your own life, not just what you can do and not just what you can harness. And there may be some other things that you're able to do that are unique to you as a person. But those aren't just like image-bearing things. Now, there are some things that go with that. Karen was given authority in the world to make a difference. I was too. You were too. That's an image-bearer thing. We have value and worth. We have authority. We have life. So when we look at Genesis 1, suddenly there's this big narrative of God creating these little human beings and saying, these are the most incredible, wonderful things in the entire universe, and I care for them so deeply, whether they look like Einstein or whether they look like Karen. Then God continued, because he didn't just make them. Then he said, okay, now you're going to do something. Right? So, God saw all that he had made, and the Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to take care of it. Here we see this idea of authority. God made you to do something. And that is true whether you are Einstein or whether you're Karen. You're made to do something. You're made to think about things. You're made to do things with your hands. You're made to build things. You're made to make things. You are not meant to sit idly and see nothing in this world happen. You were made to impact things. You were made to do things. And that is part of being human. And anytime we're not doing things, that runs counter to how we're made. And as we're going to see as we move through this course, when something like mental illness affects us, and people go through a phase where they're not able to do the things they did before, it can affect us in pretty profound ways because this is counter to how we're made, right? If we're made to do things, not doing things isn't just, oh, I have an obligation, I need to do something. This is actually counter to creation. I'm not doing something, I am made to do something. And that affects us. Now, the next thing about Genesis is God looks at all he's done, and God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. To be clear, God just planted human beings in a garden on planet Earth and said, okay, they've got dominion of this thing, they're going to rule over it. And it does not say that Adam knows how to use a shovel. Does not say that he knows how to weed or how to take care of plants or how to take care of animals. It doesn't say he knows how to do anything horticultural whatsoever. And then God looks at it and says, this is very good. In the Hebrew, it says, this is tov tov. This is so good. You could even translate it, this is as perfect as I could want it to be. This is fantastic. God has his image bearer in the garden with no idea what he's doing necessarily, but he represents him and he is with him. And this is exactly the way God wanted it to be. And that brings us back to this picture of brokenness and homelessness. Because this isn't the way that God created the world to be. This is broken. This is against that idea that I was made to do something. I was made to contribute, to create, to build, to make, to do, to be of value. When I am treated as I am not valuable, and I cannot create, and I cannot do, and I can just survive, and that's all that matters. So bringing back dignity to people means more than just how we provide a little bit for them. It means restoring them to the way they were created to be. This Genesis 1 idea of I am valuable because I am valuable, that I am good because I am good, that God created me like this to make a difference in the world, and that is a beautiful thing. That is juxtaposed directly against some of the realities that we see, realities that we experience in our day-to-day lives. And when we see a picture like this, we have to ask, is she an image bearer? The answer is yes. And when we see the homeless man, we have to say, is he an image bearer? And the answer is yes. And it's not just they who are, it's you. You are the most valuable thing in the known universe next to God himself. You matter more than anything in the universe to God. Your life matters. Every part of you matters. Every relationship that you have matters. All of you matters. And all of you is made in the image and likeness of God. So as we step forward through the rest of this course, we're going to be looking back at how it is that these image bearers who are made so valuable and so worthy and so well are often in these crazy places that break how we see the image of God, that break our experience of what it is to be an image bearer, and how we can restore those things. Thank you very much, and I'll see you again in section 3.